Case number 09-1108. Gregory Sean Winton, petitioner, versus National Transportation Safety Board et al. Mr. Winton for petitioner, Mr. Berry for respondents.
May it please the court, Gregory Winton. I am the petitioner in this matter. Assisting me at council table is my law clerk, Aaron Arpey, who assisted on the briefs. The relief that we are seeking here today is a reversal of the NTSB order, which affirmed an order of suspension issued by the Federal Aviation Administration suspending my commercial pilot and certified flight instructor certificates for a period of 30 days. In the alternative, I am seeking a remand to the NTSB with specific instructions that the suspension should be waived because I was denied due process in the proper notice that should have been given to me in accordance with the Administrative Procedures Act, and because the NTSB allowed the FAA to divert and from its policy and procedure and establish case law without a reasoned explanation to do so. In this case, the FAA's grossly inefficient handling of this matter, from the investigation through to the hearing, resulted in inadequate notice being provided to me as a respondent concerning the order of suspension, which in effect denied me the opportunity to fully and fairly litigate the issues at the hearing with regard to an affirmative defense of an equipment malfunction. And as a result, I suffered substantial prejudice as a result of the inefficient notice. In affirming the FAA's order of suspension, the NTSB, in addition, violated the Administrative Procedure Act because it acted in an arbitrary and capricious manner. Specifically, this court has found in the past, most recently in Moshe against the NTSB, Judge Kavanaugh on the decision, and Ramak Prakash against the NTSB, in which the NTSB has strayed from its policy and procedure, established precedent, without a reasoned explanation for the departure. And we must remind once again the NTSB and the FAA, if they are going to stray from established policy and procedure, that a reasoned explanation is required.
What exactly is this? Is it the delay you're talking about or something else?
Your Honor, there's actually two major points here. First of all, the flight was a 26-minute flight.
All right, well, let me just ask.
Sure.
You are not contesting... Your challenge is procedural. In other words, you're not contesting that you were without a transponder or that they could not raise you by the transponder for these 4.5 minutes. You're not contesting that.
No, what I am contesting are two major issues. One, that I wasn't provided notice at the time of the pilot deviation, in accordance with FAA Handbook 71-1065, the controller's handbook, or immediately after the flight, because again, I was positively identified after the first 4.5 minutes.
Didn't the board say that the reason for the former is that you weren't in communications with the air traffic controller?
Correct.
Only obligated to provide immediate notice if you're in contact with them, and you weren't, and nothing in the regulation says that they have to do it.
Well, it's an interesting
phone or by email afterwards.
It's an interesting scenario, Your Honor. I'm glad you brought it up because this Washington D.C.
You brought it up.
This Washington D.C. aid is okay. It has been designed as a result of 9/11, obviously.
Yeah, but can you just? Isn't it right that the agency's position is that their obligation to inform you immediately is only if you're in communications with them?
Because the air traffic control manual only specifies those instances when the pilot is speaking to air traffic control.
Yeah, that's so you agree with it.
Yes, but in
why is there any problem in the agency's reliance on that?
Because in this scenario, the pilot is being provided air traffic control service with a discrete transponder code, but yet has been excluded from the notice to airmen to be in two-way radio communication with that air traffic controller. If the pilot remains in the airport traffic area of a non-towered airport, Gaithersburg, Maryland.
So you say you had no obligation to be in contact?
Correct. And if you look at the notice to airmen specifically, it has six, seven enumerated requirements. And one of those requirements is to maintain two-way radio communication unless the pilot is exempted from the two-way radio communication in accordance with notice to airmen number, I've got it right here.
And therefore, it's during those periods of time when they had no obligation to advise you immediately.
Oh, no. I'm not saying that they had no obligation. I'm saying that they weren't talking to me. The obligation still stands. We have to look at the reason for the notice requirement.
In communications, how could they advise you immediately?
Oh, easily. First of all, they did make a call to the airport, non-towered airport, by landline. And they said, which aircraft is operating that's not squawking a code?
And it wasn't to you.
Well, it was, right, it was to the airport. However,
you were in the airplane, right?
I'm sorry?
You were in the airplane.
I was in the airplane. Once I landed, see, they positively identify my aircraft, watch me land, and watch me not fly again. At that point, there's an obligation to notify me so that I can begin my notes and begin my defense of any pilot deviation of which I had no notice. This scenario, by the way, when a transponder is not detected by radar, is similar to when you drive your car and your left taillight is out. Driving the car, you would never know that. Unless, one, if somebody stops and tells you, or two, a police officer stops and gives you a warning or a ticket.
So when you're preparing to take off, there's no test to see if the transponder is working?
Absolutely not. Correct. When they turn it on, it's one of those, you set it and forget it. You turn it on, it shows the numbers, you dial in the four-digit code, 5352. I confirmed that it was there. The controller even said, yes, he read it back correctly. And when I take off, there's a reply light that flashes, meaning it's being interrogated. All of that took place. So the only way I would know that it's not being detected is if the controller told me. It's such a common occurrence, by the way, Your Honor, that the FAA Air Traffic Control Handbook how could he tell me?
Suppose you hadn't turned around and landed. How could he have told you that the transponder wasn't working since you weren't in communications?
They do it all the time. What happens is, I'll tell you, what they do is they track my aircraft, and they watch till it goes to the next controller. And if the next controller I'm speaking to, they tell him, remind this pilot. Then when I get on the ground at the non-towered airport, they contact the airport. It happens all the time. It happens in every one of these ADIS cases.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding you, but if you had, suppose, how long would your flight have taken if you had not come back?
26 minutes.
Okay. Were you in communications with air traffic? Would you have been in communications with air traffic control at any time?
I was before I took off. I attempted immediately after taking off.
After you took off?
No, but I'm required to contact air traffic control to file a flight plan and close the flight plan.
During the 26 minutes,
right,
when the flight would have been airborne, just that time, would you have been in contact, voice contact with air?
As a result of the exclusion in the notice to airmen, no.
Okay, so then how during that flight could anyone have told you that your transponder wasn't working other than sending up a plane to fly along next to you and flap its wings?
That's not how it works. They actually call the airport. And there's somebody at the airport at Gaithersburg at all times.
Communicate with you.
There's a radio. The common traffic advisory frequency. Keep in mind, if I'm operating in the ADIS at Gaithersburg.
I don't get it.
But even if they didn't, Your Honor, Judge Henderson, to answer your question, the second prong is not only did they not notify me in accordance with the handbook, and maybe there's an exception in this case, but they failed to notify me after the flight so that I can prepare my defense. Because the first notification I received was 5 weeks after the flight. At that time, my memory had faded. In fact, there's a statement in the record that says, I don't even remember if I was flying that day. The aircraft is owned by two other pilots.
All right, how about in January of 2005 when the transponder malfunctions? And granted, this NPCA is out there floating around somewhere. Why didn't that give you notice, since you were told that you weren't squawking an appropriate transponder code in the, at least the investigation indicated that. Why didn't that raise some flag in your mind? Maybe this is what happened back in June of 2004, and keep whatever the transponder to show this short circuiting.
I'll tell you why. The notice of proposed certificate action, which initially was sent to me September 9th, 3 months after the flight, said specifically, you failed to comply with all the operating requirements and procedures specified in the NOTAM, including the special security instructions contained therein. That's my mindset. So I took that information and I requested the enforcement.
All, they said all, right?
All.
There were seven, three of which were transponder related.
Right, but I
You knew right then that you had a transponder charge.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. Because if you looked at the enforcement investigative report, which appears in our appendix A-525 through 560, it says specifically, the first page of the enforcement investigative report, summary of facts, he was not squawking an appropriate transponder code and did not have air traffic control authorization while operating in the ATIS. So in my mind, if you told me today, Mr. Winton, you're not wearing the appropriate clothing to be arguing before this court, I'm thinking I'm wearing a tuxedo or a jogging suit. It doesn't mean I'm not squawking any clothes. I'm not naked. So it didn't say he didn't squawk any code inappropriate. And if you look deeper into the enforcement investigative report, specifically the air traffic controller statement, it's appendix A552.
Did the same documents say that you were being tracked? You were tracked as a primary target?
Yeah, well,
and isn't a primary target something that shows up on radar, but no, when there's no transponder?
Yes, but
there were, so this thing was internally inconsistent.
Exactly, it was confusing.
You could have asked for a clarification.
Well, not at this point. The only time under the procedures of the NTSB rules of practice is once the complaint is issued, the order of suspension is issued, and I appeal it, it's now a complaint. That's the first time I have an opportunity to make a motion for a more definite statement or begin discovery, and I did that immediately. I began the discovery process. And for the first time, in response to interrogatories, in February of 2007, 2 years and 8 months after this case, was after the flight, I was first notified by the FAA that for a 4.5 minute period of time, my aircraft appeared as a primary target. Not that I violated or didn't comply with all the requirements. That was an inaccurate and misleading statement. And if you look at the appendix A552, the controller said, it is my understanding that the pilot then departed, remained in the pattern at Gaithersburg, and squawked 1200. There's the evidence of the inappropriate code. I never squawked 1200. So reading this package misled me to believe that the FAA misidentified my aircraft with another violator, and I never needed to go look at my transponder. I sent this entire file to one of my experts who handled over 2,000 ATIS violations for the FAA before he retired. And he said, Greg, based on the factual basis of the FAA's investigation, it said you operated in the ATIS without a proper clearance, and you operated in the ATIS without first contacting air traffic control to receive proper clearance. That is A-526. Those are the allegations in the EIR enforcement report. My expert reviewed it and said there's no evidence to support that. The FAA is wrong.
Let me ask you something, because you are an experienced litigator in this. There's this whole year that goes by, 2005, you have received the notice of proposed certificate action. And I can't tell that anything else is going on until September of, I think, 06. Is that right?
Yes. No,
December of 06.
Yes.
That's when you get the
order
suspension notice, right? What status are you in? I mean, you can continue to fly, but what status are you in when you have a notice of proposed certificate action?
I'm still an active pilot. It's just a charge, an allegation. And having done these types of cases for 20 years, there are a certain percentage of them that are based on misidentification of aircraft. And in those cases, those notices that have lasted 2 or 3 years typically get dismissed or withdrawn because they realize the FAA after a while, yeah, it was a misidentified aircraft. There is no violation here.
Is there any obligation on you or have you, and this is outside the record, but if you were representing somebody, with this hanging notice of proposed certificate action, not at least say, Have you all ever resolved this? Did you discover that you had the wrong plane or something?
Yes. Procedurally, no, there's nothing I could do other than pick up the phone to Mr. Jim Barry, who I've known for about 20 years. We both worked with the agency together. And I said, hey, Jim, by the way, I'm just telling you, the evidence here, and I sent it to my experts, is that I did comply with all the requirements. Keep in mind, the 7 requirements, I did comply with all 7. The only issue was, for the first 4.5 minutes, did I comply with number 6? That's the only issue that was litigated. So I was never told that until January of 2007. Keep in mind, it was 2 years and 7 months after the flight that even though I had requested the document, the FAA failed to disclose the preliminary pilot deviation report dated June 15, 2004. That was finished 1 week after my flight. That was A505 in the appendix. It specifically stated the transponder was not functioning, in parentheses, the word broken. I was not given that for, like I said, 2 years and 7 months without any explanation by the agency. No good cause shown for the delay in that document. I would agree, Your Honor, if I received that in the initial enforcement investigative report, I would have immediately looked into that as the issue rather than misidentification of an aircraft without a proper clearance as alleged.
Now, how about this form labeled Preliminary Pilot Deviation Report, the first one, right. Not the one in, in 2007. It checked not functioning, broken or off.
Well, the initial one appears on Appendix A531.
Box 18
says transponder operating with altitude reporting. So the FAA affirmatively told me in September, 3 months after the flight, that my transponder was operating with altitude reporting, which is confirmed again by the controller statement that said I was squawking 1200, A552.
All right, but wasn't there another controller at the same time who disputed that? Or wasn't in the investigation report, wasn't there another controller saying it was off for 4.5 minutes?
Oh, no, not at all. A553 is what you're referring to. In that, the controller said aircraft appeared to depart Gaithersburg as a primary target. I started track 85. Aircraft started squawking 5352 and was identified as November 724 Tango X-ray. He doesn't say 4.5 minutes, and I will tell you that because of the altitude of the field at Gaithersburg, every aircraft initially departs as a primary target. In fact, in the record, it said the aircraft that departed immediately before me appeared as a primary target until the transponder did, in fact, show up at a certain altitude. It's between 8 and 1,100 feet.
I haven't heard that argument before. I mean, did I miss something? So you're saying that all planes have this 4-minute gap?
Not a 4-minute gap. Remember, I don't know how long the gap was because I was never told.
It says in the record it was 4 minutes.
Well, I was never told that until 2 years and 7 months after the flight.
Well, but are you saying that all planes that take off from Gaithersburg have a gap?
I have a gap, absolutely. Absolutely. It was confirmed. And again, I'm limited in my pages and words in the briefs. I didn't argue the point because it's extraneous.
That seems to me would have been totally dispositive if that's true. I mean, if all planes taking off have a 4-minute gap.
Not a 4-minute gap. It's depending on the altitude. Keep in mind, my aircraft.
Is the altitude of the airport always the same?
No, the altitude of the aircraft, sir, on takeoff.
I thought you said it had to do with the altitude of the airport.
Correct. The altitude of the airport when the aircraft takes off precludes the radar from, because it's 500 and some odd feet above ground.
The radar can't pick it up?
Right, until the aircraft is at a certain altitude on the climb.
But, hold on. I'm confused. Okay. When a plane takes off from Gaithersburg,
yes.
The airport is too low for the radar to pick up. Is that the point?
That's what I have been told, and that's what the evidence showed.
But your plane apparently was picked up by radar after, I guess, reached a certain altitude.
But we don't know what the altitude was.
No, but wasn't it identified as a primary target at that point?
It was.
So doesn't that mean that it was flying without a working transponder?
Not necessarily.
No, I thought that was a definition of a primary target.
No, it means that the secondary radar antenna has not yet detected the transponder code.
Can I ask you just one other question?
Please.
You say that you didn't know you had a transponder problem until later. It was just an air traffic control problem, right?
I did not know there was a problem with my transponder during that flight, correct?
Okay. You say in your reply brief, page 1.
Okay.
I think you're talking about the conversation with the, whatever that fellow's name is, Bond or something. You say, you were told that the flight was made without ATC clearance, right?
Correct.
And that he did not squawk an appropriate transponder.
Correct.
Okay, so you knew right at the beginning you had a transponder problem.
Oh, no. Again, when we talk about not appropriate transponder, as I mentioned earlier, that means I was squawking something other than the 5352.
Which was inappropriate, right?
It would have been if I...
My only point is that you knew right at the beginning you had a transponder program. You might have a problem. You might have misunderstood exactly what it was, but you knew it was a transponder problem.
So no,
how would that affect, right?
When I was told that I was squawking a non-appropriate code, I looked at the enforcement investigative report, and it said that I squawked a 1200 code, according to the air traffic controller, appendix A552. So that's where the definition of the inappropriate code came from. It didn't say that I wasn't squawking any code.
Okay. Am I right? You made two attempts to... establish radio contact with somebody.
Yes.
Who was that?
Well, when I departed, I was given a squawk code, 5352, and a departure frequency, which was Potomac TRACON, right, which is a standard procedure.
Right.
So as soon as I take off, I contact Potomac once, 724 Tango X-ray, do you hear me? Second time, as soon as I don't get a response, it's my requirement, remember, to stay in the airport traffic pattern, right, because I can't operate in the ADIS unless I'm talking to somebody.
So you hear nothing the first time, then you try again,
right,
and you hear nothing the second time.
Right.
All right. What does that trigger in your mind?
Very common. One of two things. The controller is too busy. It happens all the time. And if that's the case, it was a flight for currency. It wasn't necessary that I needed to be someplace. So I stayed in the traffic pattern. I could have either waited until he was less busy, or I wasn't high enough in my climb. Because, again, radio frequencies, they can only pick you up when you're at a certain altitude on your climb out.
But you didn't try again. Instead, you landed, right?
Yeah, well, I stayed in the traffic pattern, did a landing or two, and I landed. Correct.
So why didn't that make you think? You weren't just going up there to circle the airport and come down again. You aborted whatever flight plane you had, right?
Well, no, it was really just a flight for proficiency purposes. Every pilot needs to do three landings every 90 days.
Okay, but your flight plan was not to go up, circle around and land, was it?
Right. It was go to another airport, practice a landing, then come back.
All right. And you didn't do that.
Right.
And it seems to me, if you get two radio contacts and no answer and you don't try the third one and land instead, that's consistent with thinking something's wrong.
Oh, I didn't immediately land. I literally flew for another 21 minutes. Or actually,
never tried to get in contact again.
No, because I have to maintain the common traffic advisory frequency to maintain clear of the other traffic at Gaithersburg. It was a busy day. It was a summer evening. So I have to maintain vigilance in see and avoid and maintain proper communications with the traffic at Gaithersburg. In addition, I was monitoring the Potomac approach control frequency. So if they did get back to me, then I would have, you know, said, okay,
fine. Right. So you were in contact with the Gaithersburg people as you were flying around the airport. You didn't try to get the air traffic controller at Potomac again.
Right. I have to choose one or the other. I can't be on both at the same time. But I did monitor it nonetheless. I'd like to reserve some of my rebuttal time unless there's other questions.
You're way over it. Do you have any questions? All right. All right.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Berry?
May it please the court, I'm James Berry, and I am representing the Federal Aviation Administration in this matter. To address Mr. Winton's first point, Mr. Winton presents no authority whatsoever to support his contention that the due process right to adequate notice required the FAA to contact him immediately after the incident in question. He cites two cases, Galt and Wolf, neither of which support his position. In fact, these cases speak of oral notice given either not before a hearing or not soon enough before a hearing to allow for an adequate preparation of a defense. The NTSB case that he relies on, Administrator versus Brasher, provides no support for his position that the FAA failed to comport with due process notice requirements by by not advising him of the incident or the violation immediately after it took place. And this is true for two reasons. One, Brashard is a case that does not turn on due process notice rights. In fact, what happened in Brashard was that the board concluded that the FAA failed to follow its own policy, that controllers in radio contact with pilots notify pilots of deviations. In that circumstance, the board concluded that no sanction would be imposed where the deviation was from an altitude or separation instruction. Brashard does not suggest that fundamental due process rights would be implicated either in the absence of a Brashard warning or even in the absence of the policy upon which Brashard is based. In fact, under Galt and Wolf, upon which Mr. Winton relies, adequate notice is provided when the recipient receives sufficient notice of the allegations considered and resolved at the hearing. These cases do not require immediate notification. Second, Brashard should not be expanded in this case because the policy upon which it's based, which is paragraph 2-1-26 and FAA Order 7110-63M, which is the Air Traffic Controller Handbook, isn't applicable to this case. Paragraph 2-126 requires, at minimum, ongoing two-way radio communications between a pilot and a controller. In such a circumstance, the controller is required to inform the pilot of a deviation, workload permitting. In this case, Mr. Winton was not engaged in two-way radio communication with air traffic control. Mr. Winton suggests that he remained in the traffic pattern for the entire length of his flight. The evidence reflects otherwise. He was in the traffic pattern certainly for a portion of the flight. However, this flight was a 26-minute flight. He did not remain in the traffic pattern for 26 minutes. He went outside of the traffic pattern. And yet, he failed to establish and engage in two-way radio communications with the controller during that period of time. And for the same reason...
That's not the violation, is it?
No, we did not allege that violation, Your Honor.
What does that have to do with anything we're dealing with here?
Well, Mr. Winton suggested that that he did not need to be in contact with air traffic control.
Let's focus on the issue. I thought your point was that there was no obligation to tell him immediately because he wasn't in communications.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he says, well, there was ways in which you could have told him, even though he wasn't in communication with air traffic controllers. Is that not right?
The administrator does not agree with that particular position. In fact, the policy upon which Brashard is based, which is this paragraph 2-1-26, requires, at minimum, ongoing two-way radio communications. There was no such communication in this case. And now Mr. Winton asserted during his opening argument that the FAA somehow should have contacted him either hours or days after the flight by this telephone number that he provided to the flight service station. Number one, Brashard, that is the policy that underlies Brashard, requires air traffic notifying him. Beyond that, the policy requires ongoing radio communication during the time of the notification of the deviation. In this case, Mr. Winton did leave his telephone number with somebody, but that somebody was a flight service personnel, not air traffic control, but flight service, received his telephone number pursuant to his filing a flight plan to allow him to operate in and out of the DC-8s. So, for the controller or to have contacted him, this controller would have had to go through all the channels necessary in order to get all the way to this Altoona, Pennsylvania, flight service station to have gotten that telephone number, to have contacted him, and then to have notified him of the deviation. And this and the policy upon which Brashard is based, 2-126, certainly does not contemplate that sort of action by the air traffic controller. Air traffic doesn't have the resources to actually engage in that sort of contact.
That answers the 5 weeks. But what was going on in 2005, at least, in response to Mr. Winton's claim of undue delay, let's put it that way, In your reply brief, you simply say, well, we didn't violate the five-year statute of limitations. I mean, is this typical? We don't know what went on. There's nothing about what went on for at least an entire year.
Well, we believe that
business, or I mean, you've given no explanation.
I can tell you that during this period of time, there was a tremendous amount of there's a high workload insofar as enforcement action. So that may have contributed to the delay. However, that doesn't really answer your question. I think to properly answer your question, we have to look at the notice that Mr. Winton received along the way. Number one, he received notification from an FAA inspector who told him that he did not have the appropriate transponder code while operating the DC-8s, and he received this 5 weeks after the incident in question. Secondly, he received the notice of proposed certificate action. This notice alerted him to the fact that he did not comply with the requirements of NOTAM 321-26. And one of those seven requirements is that he continuously transmit an air traffic control issued transponder code while operating in the DC-8s. We believe he received notice through that document. But beyond that, we believe that the EIR, the Enforcement Investigative Report, fully apprised him as to what was going on in this case and what the agency's basis for the notice was. In fact, there are two pieces of documentation and the EIR, which supports the agency's position. Number one, there is a personnel statement from the controller who was actually monitoring the ADIS position, and that controller statement states that this aircraft departed Gaithersburg as a primary target. The controller was notified by customs that it was a primary target. Following that notification, the controller tracked this aircraft using a tracking mechanism, a computer-based tracking mechanism. Thereafter, the aircraft began to squawk the transponder code it was assigned, 5352. In addition to that controller statement, there was a preliminary pilot deviations report which says much the same thing, that around 2331, he departed from Gaithersburg as the primary target. A track was begun. In other words, it's not a situation where he departed and for a second or so until he climbed to a higher altitude, he was a primary target.
All right, let me stop you.
Yes.
All this stuff you've just mentioned, when was it all gathered up? Was it in the EIR,
the Enforcement
EIR Investigative? That he got in September?
Yes, Judge Henderson.
All right, so you still haven't answered. I mean, is it just the typical lag time that in between the investigation and when you finally suspend a license or give the notice of suspension, it normally takes 2 years? Or?
Your Honor, there's a couple factors at play. Number one, Mr. Winton requested an informal conference, and there was some give and take with respect to whether he actually wanted to receive an informal conference. Now, let me explain this. When the FAA issues a notice, one of the options in after receiving a notice of proposed certificate action is to allow the airman to have an informal conference with the attorney assigned to the case. It's during the course of this informal conference that information is exchanged. Following this information, the FAA makes a determination as to what to do next, whether to go forward with the case, whether to drop it, etc. So a part of this delay can be explained by Mr. Winton's vicissitudes with respect to wanting to undergo an informal conference or receive an informal conference. Ultimately, he decided against receiving an informal conference.
Now, when was that ultimately?
I believe a letter was sent to him after this give and take. A letter was sent to him on August 30th or 31st of 2006, and then following that, the agency issued the order.
So I keep coming back to the whole year of 2005, you all are going back and forth on informal conferencing?
No, Your Honor. I don't want to. That was an aspect of it. Another aspect of it was attorney workload, to be perfectly blunt. There are a lot of cases, and I'm sure Your Honor can understand that there are a lot of cases. In fact, there are a lot of ADIS cases. But beyond that, there was that it is what it is, insofar as that delay is concerned. But I think what I'd like to direct your honor to is the fact that Mr. Winton testifies at transcript page 932 through 934 that in quote unquote probably March or April of 2006, or about a year before the hearing, he received customs data and he received the second preliminary pilot deviation report. That's in the transcript. The customs data plainly sets out that he was operating in the DC-8s without transmitting a transponder code for a period of about 4.5 minutes before he began squawking the transponder code 5352. In the second preliminary pilot deviation report, that's the one that says transponder not functioning, in parentheses, broken or off. So he gets that a year ahead of time. In addition, he testified that, quote, that he probably informed, strike that quote, in response to the question posed to him on cross-examination, do you remember when you first informed the FAA that November 724 Tango X-ray had an intermittently functioning transponder? Answer, I probably told you as soon as I found out from Mike Tarasio. That would have been around March of 2006, again, about a year before the hearing. So there is all kinds of evidence.
That was 2005.
No, okay, so what happened, and I can clarify that. He takes his aircraft in to have Mr. Tarasio perform an annual inspection around December of 2005. It's that around that time Mr. Tarasio purportedly performed work on the aircraft, including purportedly replacing a circuit breaker. Now, it turns out that no circuit breaker was replaced. The ALJ completely discredited that testimony for a variety of reasons. So now we're moving into 2006. Mr. Tarasio signed a maintenance release indicating that he performed some work, including an annual inspection, as well as the circuit breaker replacement, and he finished that, or he signed off on that in March of 2006. And then the agency issued its order in December of 2006. And then the hearing took place basically between March of 2007 and October of 2007. And if I just might add this last point, Mr. Winton suffered absolutely no prejudice in this case. He was given every opportunity to try this matter. He introduced all kinds of maintenance records from the time the transponder was installed in the aircraft all the way until the time the Tarasios purportedly repaired it. And then thereafter, he testified that when he testified at the hearing that he had had no transponder problems after the Tarasios repaired it. He points to nothing that would support any sort of prejudice whatsoever. And finally, and I covered this in my brief, I'll just do it briefly at the indulgence of your court. Overwhelming evidence supports that there simply was no transponder malfunction. The transponder was tested at installation back in.
Is this relevant to the question we have to decide?
I think it is, Your Honor, just because, among other things, Mr. Winton must show specific prejudice, and he has not done that. He has failed to do that. So even assuming that the court finds some level of traction with his notice argument, there is still no traction to that argument because there's no prejudice by virtue of a number of things. And if your court will, I can go over these things.
Let me just ask.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you have any questions?
No. All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
We've got your argument. All right, Mr. Winton has no time left, but if you want to take a minute, Mr. Winton.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's important to note that with regard to the due process argument, the inexcusable delay in that preliminary pilot deviation report, A502, that's the one that said the transponder was not functioning. Nothing before that did I ever get notice of non-functioning. It was over a year and a half late to Mr. Berry. It was over 2 years late when I got it. When we talk about due process. It is the ability to receive the information critical to the issues to be presented at trial, 4.5 minutes of no transponder, so that I can prepare a defense. Mr. Berry says, it is what it is. It is what it is not a response to the inexcusable delay in providing key information to my defense. This is a case of first impression before this circuit court or any circuit court of appeals. The notice provided by an agency concerning a pilot certificate action, very important. If we look to the Fourth Circuit, there was a similar scenario in Lane Hollow Coal versus Department of Labor. In that case, the court held that no process, however thorough, can provide what is due without notice to those who stand to lose out thereby. The notice must be received within a reasonable time and when deprivation can still be prevented. Information concerning the malfunction was forever lost months after the flight. The NTSB has already held that information of a malfunction 7 months after a flight is too long of a time. I didn't receive it for over 2 years. Speculation about the would have been and could have been misconstrues the focus of our inquiry. The due process clause does not create a right to win litigation. It creates a right not to lose without a fair opportunity to defend oneself. The Fourth Circuit was citing the Supreme Court of the United States from back in 1915, Coe versus Armour Fertilizer Works, 237 U.S. 413, where the Supreme Court said, to one who protects against the taking of his property without due process of law, it is no answer to say that in his particular case, due process of law would have led to the same result, which is, thank you, Your Honor. We ask that you reverse the board's order.
Thanks a lot.